God bless you. Christmas traditions are so interesting to me. Traditions are customs or beliefs that are passed down from generation to generation, and they often include behaviors. It's not just what you think about a certain situation, but stuff that we do really pretty much only at this time of year, and they have their roots all the way in the past. Isn't it interesting how things that happen in the past get passed down from generation to generation, and they're just as important, or they should be, or we're told that they should be just as important to us as they were to great, 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 sometimes grandparents who've been long gone. It's interesting how that information, have you ever heard the story about the lady with the pan and the roast? Some of you have heard that story, some of you haven't. So this lady gets ready to prepare the Christmas roast. I don't even know if it was Christmas, maybe Thanksgiving, doesn't matter. For our purposes, it's Christmas. She gets ready to prepare the Christmas roast. And before she puts it in the pan, she cuts the end off. And she puts it in the pan, and it cooks. And then somebody asked for the first time that year, why did you cut the end off of the roast? And the lady thought, I don't know. Let me ask my mom. So she called her mom and she said, Mom, do you still cut the end off of the roast? And her mother said, of course. And she said, why do we cut the end off of the roast? And her mom goes, you know, I'm not really sure. Let me call my mom. So we called the grandma, who at this point is in her 90s. And mom says to grandma, Grandma, have we always cut the end off of the roast? And her grandmother says, absolutely. And her mother said, why did we cut the end off the roast? She said, because my pan never fits the full roast. Isn't that interesting? How tradition just begins to pass down. And sometimes we just kind of, I mean, after a while, pans got bigger. But for that lady, the pan stayed the same and the roast never fit. So she just cut the end off it, cooked the roast, and then would cook the end later. Got passed down for three generations. Isn't it interesting how traditions take hold? How they become part of who we are and what we do. At Christmas, the lights at my house were always significant. Now, I'm not talking about significant like they are at the Air home. If you want to go see a Christmas light extravaganza, you need to drive past Keith and Louise Air's house. I don't really know how to describe it to you. I'm pretty sure you can see it from space. I could be wrong, but I feel like if the Hubble were still up there doing its thing, it could pinpoint Keith and Louise's house for way out in space. It's a lot of lights. Keith loves the light show. He puts a lot of work into it. That makes total sense why sometimes it's still up in February. But anyway, Christmas lights were a tradition at my home as well. My father had these little fake, they were plastic and they were electric, but they looked like candles. Do you know what I'm saying? Like they were molded in a way that looked like wax was coming down them, which was so bizarre to me, but whatever. And they had that one little incandescent, like a 5-watt bulb that you screwed in to it, right? Clear bulbs, always clear bulbs, never colored. Colored bulbs in those things in homes look weird to me. You ever passed homes that have like that one blue candle in it? That's creepy for me. That's just not my tradition. That's very unfamiliar. So as I got older, my father taught me, this is how you do it. You find one, you take the one candle, you put it in the middle of the frame. It has to go in the middle of the windowsill. If it's off to the left or off to the right, that doesn't look right. It's got to be in the middle. Unless, for some reason, the pane of the window comes down the center, and then you bump it just to the right. Not to the left. Just to the right. You can't have one to the left and one to the right. It all needs to be the same. And then you taped the bases down so that the curtains could close, and then you plugged it into the socket. There were some sockets that weren't close enough. Those were bundled together with an extension cord. Does that make sense? And then one year my father was like, it's time for level two, and he bought timers for all of them. So then you would set the timers, and it was really important to go as fast as you could because you didn't want the house turning on like one window at the time or one section at the time. You wanted it to all come on pretty much in the same moment. My dad was serious about that. And he was so smart because he challenged me. He was like, how fast can you do it? And I was like, I can do this super fast. I had no idea I was doing this man's job. No clue. But that's how it started for me. And it was those single candles in the house that I grew up in. Every year, those single candles. The wreath was a big deal. My father bought a specific wreath that was made out of this green foam that you could stick stuff in. You know what I'm talking about? So he would stick the greenery in, but then he wrapped it in either a gold or a silver tinsel. And there was a bow, a big red bow that went at the bottom. And the bow had to, I mean, it was like a bow that you would see on TV. You know what I'm saying? Like a cartoon bow. It had to be the right, and it had the points cut into it. You know what I'm saying? So it came down and it had the points and it was kind of a little glossy. And that hung on the front of the house. Traditionally, we had a sign there that said Spearman's on it. We would take that down with great reverence and honor. And we would put that away, and then the Christmas wreath would go up. And my father had a special light that was stuck right there, and there was a cord, and it was waterproof, and it went into the thing. And that was really traditional at my house. It wasn't really, I mean, until those lights were up, that was Christmas at my house. We had a live tree for years as I was growing up. And it was a thing. We went out to this one place because my dad knew he could get the best price from this one tree farmer guy. And it wasn't even close. We went down to like Griffin. That doesn't mean anything to you, but that's a long drive from Fayetteville. That's a long way. That's not close. And we would go and we would pick it. And my dad would always intentionally pick one that the trunk of it was a little slanted. If you tried to buy the straight ones, they would ding you for like an extra $10. But if you would buy the ones that were kind of straight but were a little bit canted, that was always like a challenge for him. And he would make me dig down, and we'd have to cut really close to the ground because he wanted to get as much of the trunk as possible. This is how he outsmarted the salesman, right? Because if you go down far enough, the trunk gets straighter here at the bottom. So he would get an extra $5 or $10 off of the one that had like a little crook to it. And then the rest of that afternoon was spent with, as he measured the tree. And he would make sure to cut the angle at the bottom just right so that when you hammered the, are you hearing me? You hammered the tree stand on. It had spikes in the bottom. It was, he had repainted it 3 times. It was probably from the 1800s, if I had to guess. I don't know. It had been passed down for generation to generation. He would hammer that on and then had the screws on the side. And he would set it on the front porch, which was canted. The front porch was about to fall off the house. I don't know why he did it on the front porch. Anyway, he would set it on the front porch, and he would turn. There were 4 screws, one in the front, one in the back, one on the sides, you understand. And so that you could ultimately just sort of start to really, and he would counteract the curve in the trunk, right, that he got an extra $5 off for. So eventually it's standing as straight as it could be, and then it would have to come in the house. And there was always a big bare spot somewhere on the tree, so you would face that to the back of the room, right? And if there was a big hole somewhere, that there was one particular ornament, it was a huge ornament that he would find to hang right in that hole. Just right in there, like it was a centerpiece, like we've done this intentionally. We found a tree that would showcase this giant ornament that your great-great-grandmother had, hand-blown glass from I don't know where. Right? And then there was the decorating of the tree, but the lights had to go on first, and no one did the lights but my dad. Because nobody could do the lights. It started with the big bulbs. There were 2 full strands of the big bulbs, which had to go close to the... Are you picking up what I'm laying down for you with tradition here? Do you understand what I'm saying? It was a thing. The big bulbs close inside the tree. You had to do those first because they weighed the lens down and it wasn't ready. So you did the big bulbs close to the tree. And then there were 3 strands of the twinkly lights, but he hated the twinkly lights. So they were just white lights that didn't twinkle. If they started to twinkle, he would go mad. It was crazy. He wanted them all, no twinkling. And then those would go out, and he would wrap those in a way. He would stop. He would go back. He'd be like, no, we're too dense over here. He would move the bulbs if he felt like 2 reds were too close together. No, there was a lot of anxiety in my family when the other 3 were growing up. I can understand why. That man was a little maniacal about some things. And then once the lights were done, the rest of us were allowed to come and begin to decorate the tree. So then we would begin to decorate the tree, and we would put our stuff on. And, of course, I had... Back in the day, you made ornaments in school. Most of you probably don't do this anymore. But you made actual physical ornaments. And God bless my mom. She kept every one of those. And they were terrible. They were made out of popsicle sticks, and it was supposed to be a sled, and it wasn't. It was a ball of popsicle sticks that said Mary on it. And that was it. Pictures of myself and some crocheted thing that I had glued. It was awful. And we would put all of those on, and then the venerated ornaments came out. You would literally blow the dust off of those boxes. This was your great-great-great-great-great-great-granduncles. Who? They were all glass. They were all actual glass, and you would hang those. And then the tinsel. Then all in order. And then the icicles. We didn't do icicles every year. It was kind of on a whim. Sometimes, okay, my dad would do those last because he liked those too. In case you don't know what icicles are. They're not real icicles. They're just long strands of tinsel that some diabolical person created. They were like, I've got an idea for madness this Christmas. Let's make these cellophane shiny strips and make people put them on there. And they're the worst. They stick to everything. During the Christmas season, if you have shoes like Sunday shoes on with a flat bottom, you'd walk around the carpet and those things would begin to reach out to you. And if you got close enough, they would zap you. I don't know how many times I would stand close to, go stand by the tree. No, go stand by the tree. No, why? I'm going to get shot. Go stand by the tree. Pow, right in my ear. I don't know how many times that happened to me. It was serious. Those were the lights in the tree, biggest tradition. Eggnog was a tradition at my house. You can only get eggnog, and there's a reason for that. You can only get eggnog around this time, but my dad loved eggnog. Milk, cream, a lot of sugar, and whipped egg yolks and whites. I know it sounds gross, but it's wonderful. It's real thick. I'm not going to lie to you. This is not something you have a mug of. You have like 4 to 6 ounces of this, and then you spend the rest of your night going, clearing your throat because it's been coated by egg whites and sugar. But it was wonderful, and my dad would always, Turkey Hill was the brand. He would always come up with Turkey Hill or Golden Gallon. He would go out of his way to these little places just to get the half gallon. We didn't want a whole gallon, that was too much. And then he would bring it home, and he would put cinnamon in it, and
nutmeg.
It was always in the right. It was like the Colonel's special recipe. I don't know. He would never tell you how much it was. I'd be like, how much you put in? A little bit of this, a little bit of that. Okay. And that went with him to his grave. To this day, Dad, I don't know what you put in the eggnog. But he would mix it up himself, a little more milk to like, that was tradition for us. Pecans. Only at Christmas would my father buy a bag of pecans. He had a special cracker. He would de-shell them. Then he had these tools to break them in half and take that weird thing that's in between the nut halves. I don't know what that thing is. It's like a protective layer. I don't know. Then he would butter them all and salt them and roast them in the oven. So we had salted butter. Listen, they were wonderful. You could put them in a giant bag and just eat them by the hands full. You know what I mean? But it was only during that season, tradition. We did stockings when I was a kid. We had stockings, one for each member of the family. It wasn't an actual, like, stocking. It was that thing that's made to look like a sock. You know what I mean? Anybody know what I mean? You see them in the stores, right? It looks like a big sock that has like a name on it. And in the toe would go more nuts. I don't know why. It was just tradition. You would fill the toe with pecans, cashews. They're called Brazil nuts. They're really, really hard. They're better for throwing than they are for eating, if you know what I'm saying. Just stuff in the shell. That would go in the toe. Then there would be an orange. And then there would be some candy. Then a stocking stuffer, a little present. Then the banana. Then some more candy. Then another, right? Until at the very top, there was like just enough stuff sticking out. Everybody got one. And when you came down Christmas morning, Mom and Dad had set all of those out on different parts of the furniture. And that was the first thing that you did in my house on Christmas morning. You got to open your stocking, and it was amazing. And as I got older, things started to change. My brother got a stocking until he was in like his 40s. He was in his 40s because I was still in my teens, you know, or maybe it was his 30s. I was in my teens, but about the time I turned 20, like 1 year the stockings just weren't. And I was like, what is this madness? What has happened to our home? Has Christmas died? And my mom was like, well, we just thought nobody's a teenager anymore. I was like, he got them until he was 30. She was like, I'm not doing stockings for another 10 years until he's 40 and you're 30 just to make things even. That's not how we're doing it. The stockings went away. My mother and my father moved. And as my father's health began to decline, no more live tree. I will never forget when I walked into my home, this new home. These were my parents, people that I just thought I knew. And there was a 4-foot fake tree on a table. And I thought, is nothing sacred anymore? What are you going to do with this? And Dad was like, I'm going to fold it up and put it in a box. And I was like, Christmas is over. Cancel it. There's no reason to do this anymore. No more pecans, because my dad just couldn't, he physically wasn't able to do all that stuff anymore. But the eggnog remained steadfast. He would make my mom go get it. She would come back. He would do his laboratory thing with it. And we would still drink the eggnog. So those were our traditions. That was the stuff that we did. But as I've encountered other people's Christmas traditions, they're strange to me. There are people who open their presents on Christmas Eve. Are you aware of this? In this country, in America, people open their presents on Christmas Eve. You're not even saved. What is wrong with you? It's the day of Jesus' birth. Christmas Eve, we all go to church and there's a candlelight service where we all have the single candle with the paper thing on it and we all leave in silence. That's what Christmas Eve is for. You don't open presents. That's crazy. There are people who don't have a tree. No Christmas tree. None. You leave. Just get a passport and go somewhere else for Christmas. Why are you even spending holiday here? No Christmas tree at all. What do you eat on Christmas? There are people who eat things on Christmas Day. You have no business eating that. Some people, traditionally, I know someone, they have pizza every Christmas morning. That's against some rule of nature, I feel. Now, granted, I've eaten more pizza than the majority of you have years in your life, and I understand that. Because I'm a youth pastor for a dozen years, and you just eat pizza, that's simply what you do. But pizza on Christmas morning. Christina's family, they have a Christmas casserole. Her aunt Anne makes a Christmas casserole. It's got cheese, an egg, and sausage in it. Every year, without fail. She makes some with onions in it. And thank God some without, for those of us who are saved and filled with the Holy Ghost. So there are people who like their onion casserole, and for those of us who don't, and they also do, for lunch, cinnamon buns. They just make this huge tray of cinnamon buns, and that's just part of their tradition. And I've never done that, and it will always be weird to me. Am I grateful for it? You better believe it. But is it strange to me? Yeah. It's weird. It's hard when traditions change. It's hard when they become irrelevant because of changing circumstances or because of the time. Sometimes it's difficult for me to understand the traditions of other people because they're not familiar. And when I don't like something, when I'm not familiar with it, it doesn't feel the same to me. And I am picky about some things. I like traditional Christmas songs, but I do not want to listen to them from Thanksgiving to the New Year. I don't. That's too much Christmas for anybody. I like a certain amount of Christmas songs, and I like certain Christmas songs. I like the traditional carols. There are some, when some artists like reimagine some of these carols, I'm like, that is no good. That doesn't work. But some artists, when they do like an a cappella version, or maybe they do like a slightly different version, I like that. I love all the stuff we're mixing. Did you hear the things we were mixing? I love a mashup. I love it if the tempo is maybe a little faster or maybe a little slower. It's got maybe a different feel to it. There's some things that I like, but some things I hate. I don't like new Christmas music. There's no such thing as a new carol. You can't create something and add it to the lexicon of Christmas carols. But some new Christmas music I do like. I like it because it kind of sounds like a Christmas carol. Does that make sense? I'm so picky about some things. It's wild. It's amazing how emotionally tied I get to my traditions and how important it is to me to be familiar with things. I want the familiar. I want the traditional. I want my holiday to look like it's looked every holiday before. And when I become unfamiliar with something, I often become uncomfortable. For instance, this should be familiar to you. This is the nativity scene, right? It has all the necessary elements. We have the star. We have a couple of angels. We've got some shepherds. There are animals. And of course, the important trio of Mary, Joseph, and the baby. And she is, as she should be, wearing a blue shawl. That's how she showed up to Jerusalem pregnant, in a blue shawl. So of course she would be wearing it when he was born. There's Joseph, complete with halo. Because if anybody was a good man, Joseph was a good man. You with me? We've got some animals here. Everyone looking, of course, at Jesus, which is so funny. Watch out, they spit. Camel spit. I don't know what he's doing there. If you went to JCPenney's before this sold out, you could have gotten one. This has all the elements that you need, yes? I'm not sure why they had to make her a lady, but okay. She's a lady. It's fine. Here's one of the kings. Here's another king. Here's another king. We know that there were only three. Nope, that's not scripturally accurate, but fine. I grew up with We Three Kings of Orient Are, Buried Gifts. We've traveled so far. Fields and found more. I grew up that. Blue? You see she's in blue? It's important. He's missing a halo, but it's really hard to do that like in real life. Here's baby Jesus. We've got some animals. That's great. But then people start to get silly. This lady is a jeweler, and this is her interpretation of something that is very near and dear to me. I don't know what's happening here. These are blobs of metal that someone has poked eye holes in. That's not a sheep, and why is there a heart on its flank? No one can know. because Lisa Leonard decided this is how it should go. Now, I like the thing here, babe in a manger, star in the sky, wise men from afar, angels on high, the verse of the king, humble and low, the whole earth rejoices, redemption to know. A Savior is born, there is hope for us all, we are covered in love, each one great and small. That's not Christmas, but I like the rhyme. It's very Hallmarky. You could have gotten that at JCPenney's if you wanted, or excuse me, from Lisa Leonard if you wanted to go a little bit different. Then Nordstrom took a swing. This is almost enough for me to boycott. Do you understand what I'm saying to you? This is a $200 set of melted glass. That's what that is. Somebody is lazy. Is that a woman? Somebody was like, and it was just melted glass. That looks like a hat. That's a hat with a blob of glass in it and like a weird metal straw. What is this thing? That's chrome from a Chevy that somebody tore off? Is that some kind of kitchen utensil that's used to stir? I don't like this. I don't like this. That's not traditional for me. I don't like it. And then somebody lost their mind and really got serious about reimagining what intimacy might look like in today's world. Let me point some things out to you. There are solar panels on that. In case candlelight, you don't want to be rude to an animal and use its fat, let's just bring some solar panels. Absolutely, we need to document this with a selfie. Check us out. Day one, hashtag Merry Christmas. We got to have organic beef. You understand what I'm saying? This is a free-range cow. We don't want anybody to get upset. This cow has never been in captivity. It's 100% organic. No steroids in that. Okay? And the wise men all have Amazon packages. They're all dressed appropriately hipster, and they all showed up from afar on a Segway bearing their Amazon packages. Gold, frankincense, myrrh, if I had to guess. I'm not okay with this. In case you can't read it, and I didn't point this out, it's gluten-free feed over here. It's gluten-free. Traditions, man. I look at that, and I think it's kind of funny, but if I'm honest with you, there's a part of me where I'm like, that's sacrilegious. It's not right. Why would you do that? That's not okay. I mean, it's funny, but it's not okay. It's way better than the blobby glass stuff that was selling for $200. It's interesting how connected I am to what's familiar and how uncomfortable I can become when I am introduced to the unfamiliar. Sometimes I let my level of comfort determine my attitude, and often my attitude determines my actions. Isn't that interesting? In the Christmas story, we simply read the account. We simply read the account and we say, of course, that's just how it happened. But I am so grateful that Mary's lack of familiarity with what was going on in her body, with what she had to do being married now to a man, with the fact that he's going to cart her away 70 miles to a city where they're going to be counted, and the reason they're going to be counted is so they can pay the appropriate tax. By the way, they're newlywed and broke. I'm so grateful that she didn't allow her level of familiarity to determine her attitude and thus her actions, because she might not have made the choices that she made. We just read the story and we forget sometimes that it couldn't have been more unfamiliar to the people who were involved.
In those days, Caesar Augustus issued a decree that a census should be taken of the entire Roman world. So Joseph also went up from the town of Nazareth in Galilee to Judea, to Bethlehem, the town of David, because he belonged to the house and line of David. He went there to register with Mary, who was expecting a child. While they were there, the time came for the baby to be born, and she gave birth to her firstborn, a son. She wrapped him in cloths and placed him in a manger, because there was no room for them in the inn. Have you taken a look at a Christmas card lately? The stable is clean, and it usually has some sort of angelic glow about it. Mary hasn't even broken a sweat. The animals stand in perfect line surrounding the young couple, and everyone is in awe of what has just taken place. Would you say that that is an accurate picture of a teenager giving birth for the first time in a stable without a doctor or a midwife or even her mom to help coach her through? Christmas tradition has romanticized the birth of Jesus by getting rid of the blood, the dirt, the stench, and the tears. In some ways, it's created a false portrayal of the birth of God's Son. The truth is that stables are dark, they're full of insects, and they stink. Mary has just traveled 70 miles on a donkey, and after a long, dusty, tiring journey, she discovers that there's no room in the inn, and she'll have to give birth in a stable. Do you think this is how Mary dreamed it would turn out when she found out that she was going to give birth to the Messiah? In our own lives, we often picture how God should use us, and a lot of times it looks like a Christmas card. When things don't go according to our plans or expectations, we assume that it must not have been God. But Mary's experience in the stable shows us that even in the most confusing, unfamiliar ways, God can be present and at work. In what ways is He working in your life right now?
You know what I love the most about that video? You can go ahead and go to Luke chapter 2 if you want, because we'll be there in just 1 second. My favorite thing about that video is that she said that Mary rode to Bethlehem on a donkey. Nope. We don't have a single bit of textual evidence that said Mary did anything other than walk that 70 miles. But you know what happened? In some century long, long ago, somebody or someone's decided that couldn't be right. There's no way that a pregnant teenage girl could walk 70 miles. No husband would do that to his wife. And yeah, in that time, a donkey would have been kind of like a very expensive car in today's time. Yeah, the likelihood of them having that money or knowing anybody, because they were from a tiny middle of nowhere town, they were nobody people. The likelihood of them being, you just didn't, it wasn't rent a donkey. There wasn't enterprise. That didn't happen. You didn't call Zip Donkey and have one waiting for you at the local. That's not how it worked. But something happened in some time, a long time ago. They decided it couldn't be this way. And so they put Mary on a donkey in our tradition. And tell me you haven't heard that. Tell me you haven't heard that for years of your life. As a child, Mary was always on a donkey. There was always three wise men. They always showed up right at the moment of the birth of that child. It was always on December the 25th. That's absolutely when it happened. The shepherds always came. There was always this. It was just tradition. In our tradition, Mary rode a donkey. But in reality, that girl walked 70 miles pregnant. That's my favorite part of that, because it's become a part of that tradition, because it's become a part of our tradition. Let's go to Luke chapter 2 and read just the first 7 verses. Now in those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that a census be taken of all the inhabited earth. This was the first census taken while Quirinius was governor of Syria. And everyone was on his way to register for the census, each to his own city. Joseph also went up from Galilee, from the city of Nazareth to Judea, to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and family of David, in order to register along with Mary, who was engaged to him and was with child. While they were there, the days were completed for her to give birth, and she gave birth to her firstborn son. And she wrapped him in cloths and laid him in a manger, because there was no room for them in the inn. How many times have you heard somebody read that? How many times, as you have gotten older and finally gotten to the place where you figured out, yeah, I'm probably going to be reading the Bible, how many times have you read that? How familiar does it seem? As the years go by, it's just a story that after a while, you don't even need them. You can start to quote it. You can start to quote pieces of it. It's all so familiar. And for us, because we're on this side of the page, because we're this far removed in time, it's very comfortable. It was very, what a sweet, right? So sweet, a little baby. And man, the humility of people who had this little baby, not in a comfortable place, but probably out with some animals somewhere. And gosh, in the manger, they had to put hay in the place where the animals eat out of, and said this poor lady didn't have anywhere else to put. She found whatever cloth that she had, maybe even her traditional blue robe. Maybe she wrapped it in that, and she laid him in this manger, and they were surrounded by all of these people. Such a comfortable, familiar scene. But if you get into the details of it, comfort is the farthest thing from your mind. I appreciate so much what she said. Tradition cleanses that whole thing of the pain and intensity of childbirth. This was not in a top-of-the-line medical facility with every person from every medical practice that you could want within a moment's notice or at least within a phone call. You need a hearing guy, you can get a hearing guy. You need a vision guy, you can get a vision guy. You need a lady who does heart stuff, there's probably a lady or two in that room who do heart stuff. You've got people who've done this over and over and over for years, and all the gadgets are there. You've got the bun warmer over here. You got all the shots that you could need. You've got people waiting to take him or her if there's something wrong with him in this case. You've got people waiting to take the baby that can go to NICU real fast. And I mean, it's just, it's top of the line stuff. And she's in some dark place by candlelight having a child. There's no hermetically sealed instruments. There's no disinfectant. There's no stuff to clean the baby with other than what they've got. Maybe hopefully some clean water. It's not cold there like it is here. There are bugs. There's no air conditioning. There's nobody there to coach her through this. I mean, she was probably there for Elizabeth's birth when John came, but that's the best that she's got. It's not a comfortable situation. And she is in unfamiliar surroundings. And her husband dragged her there. The guy she's not even married to yet. They're just engaged. And he was like, we got to go to Bethlehem. And she was like, I don't know if you've noticed, but. And he was like, we got to go. Caesar, the leader of the occupying army, demands that we go get counted so he can make sure he gets his money. That's what the census was about, folks. It wasn't some romantic notion of this is a pre-birth getaway. Let's take a stroll, honey. Let's see the lights of Bethlehem. No, we have to go and be counted because Caesar wants his money. And everybody, the Roman occupation wasn't just in the Middle East. It was all over the place. At one point in time, the sun never set on the Roman Empire, if that makes sense, or at least that's what they told you. Everybody was going to be counted so that Caesar got his money. This isn't a romantic thing that's happening. He's dragging his engaged wife who was pregnant 70 miles on foot so they can pay money that they don't have to an emperor they don't serve because he controls them with an army they're not a part of. Is it touching you a little bit differently, I hope? I'm sorry to de-romanticize Christmas for you a little bit, but this is not about the traditions of lights and of wreaths. I love this stuff. Thank you for doing that. I don't want to do away with this stuff. It wouldn't be church for me if it wasn't this stuff. Now, I would struggle with that. I'm not trying to take the value out of it for you. I'm trying to add some back in. This young lady had a baby in very unfamiliar circumstances, very uncomfortable circumstances. And what's amazing to me is that out of those uncomfortable, unfamiliar circumstances came the salvation of mankind. He didn't come out of a top-level hospital birthing ward. They didn't stay at the attached hotel. He wasn't born into royalty. There was no silver spoon. What about the wise men? We have no idea if there was more than two. And they brought gold, frankincense, and myrrh because God had moved in their hearts. And everybody needs like a little jump start. You know what I'm saying? Thank God for those people who brought that money, who brought that gold and that frankincense. Now, myrrh is an interesting thing, which I'll talk about to you later, because it's a burial spice. But anyway, that's a different sermon for a different day. Thank God that she was willing to do the uncomfortable in the unfamiliar, because she gave birth to the hope and salvation of mankind. What if, when presented with the unfamiliar, when we become uncomfortable, we stopped expending so much energy and so much effort to regain our comfort? Think about that for a second. When I'm uncomfortable, listen, my wife sleeps and she likes it hot. And when I start, I can't sleep when I'm hot. I can't. She could be sweating and just be like, that's her favorite. I'm not trying to call her out right now, but that's her favorite. And sometimes I lie on my side, on the side of the bed, getting as far away from the covers as I can, like literally vertically. I'm just trying to sleep like this so that I can have as much air pass over me as possible. I like my comfort. I carry extra shirts with me in the summer because I'm whatever I get in the car and go anywhere, Even with the air conditioning, I'm going to sweat through that shirt. So before I get to where I'm going, when I get there, I will change in the shirt. I know that there, over the years, people in parking lots have been like, what is that freak doing? Because I'll be at Kroger, wherever, strip, shirt, and then I'll go in and do a thing because I don't want to walk with the pitted in the right. I like my comfort. And when I'm uncomfortable, I will expend a lot of energy. I will expend a lot of time. I will put money into being comfortable again. But what if we stop doing that? What if instead of pushing the uncomfortable away, what if we leaned into it, looking for what God might be saying, looking for what God might be wanting to do in us or through us? What if in the coming year you looked for ways to actually intentionally challenge your comfort? What if you started engaging people that maybe aren't your type of people? What if you started trying to reconnect with relationships that made you uncomfortable before, just for the sake of being in a relationship with that person again? What if you looked at your bank account, ooh, Pastor, before Christmas, for real? What if in the coming year you looked at your bank account to see if maybe there's more room for you to give than you're comfortable with? David said, I will give to the Lord nothing which costs me nothing. I will not give anything to God that doesn't cost me anything. I'm paying for this property and paying for this land that I'm going to commit to the Lord. I appreciate you offering it for free, but I won't give anything to God that doesn't cost me something. What if you looked at the way that you spend your time to see what you actually value? What if you looked up from your treasure for a second to see where your heart is? Because where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. What if you started looking around at the circles of people that you're involved in and allowed yourself to be uncomfortable with the fact that they may not see heaven? No matter how unfamiliar they might be to you, no matter how uncomfortable it might be to even think about broaching that topic or having a conversation, what if you, instead of pushing that away and staying over here where you're comfortable, what if you leaned into that discomfort, into the unfamiliar, to see what it is that God might want to say to you or do through you? What if the unfamiliar, instead of being something to be avoided, became an opportunity to be embraced with expectation to see what God can bring out? This young lady, we've got to stop romanticizing the story. We've got to stop. I do it too. Even preparing for this, I read this over and over and over because I was determined to get beyond the surface of it. I was determined to not be on this side of the page, but to go into it. To imagine what Christina Spearman might have said to me if I said, listen, I know you're pregnant, and I'm here for you. I'm here for you. I know it's God's baby. I know you're pregnant with God's baby, but I'm here for you. But I need you to go on a trip with me. We got to go to Bethlehem. I can see the look on her face right now. I can see the look on her face. She'd be like, what? I can see the look on her face because she knows we don't have a car, and she knows where Bethlehem is. Yeah, babe. We gotta go to Bethlehem. I've gotta go. I gotta go write my name down on this thing. I gotta go write my name down, and I need you to go with me because they're gonna count you too, and we're gonna have to walk. And I know you're pregnant. I can see her. I try to be there. I try to be there with this young couple who, against all odds, are trying to bring about the salvation of mankind through their obedience and commitment to God. Believing that what is happening with this young lady is from the Lord, but it's for everyone. It's for his people. And they walk 70 miles, and the place is packed. The town is packed because everybody has come from everywhere. Everybody in Bethlehem who was born in Bethlehem didn't stay in Bethlehem. They went out and they did their thing. They found jobs in Baltimore and Washington, D.C., and they had kids. And now they've all got to come back to Bethlehem, and the homes are packed, and the hospitals are full. And the local shelters are crammed, and all the hotels are filled up with people. And they find the spot that they can find. There's animals there. And then it's time for her to have this baby. I think I've painted enough of a picture. What if we stopped pushing the uncomfortable and the unfamiliar away and began to embrace it as an opportunity for God? What it is that you wants to speak to us or whatever he wants to do through us. What if in the coming year you stopped being uncomfortable with the unfamiliar and started being comfortable with the idea that God wants to do something with you in a situation? Father, I thank you so much for your word, and I thank you for this story. I pray, God, that we would stop treating it as a story, but it would become a part of our personal history, that it would become a part of our tradition, not to recount the story, not to relive the nativity scene. Even though those things are important and there's nothing wrong, my kid is learning about Advent right now. My wife is teaching my son every day about Advent, about the different candles and what they mean. They're talking about what Christmas truly means. And we're going to talk about the different pieces of that. How there were shepherds in the field who experienced the supernatural theophany of the angelic. How there were people from a different land, people who were connected to you somehow, even though we call them wise men, whether they were kings or not, we don't know, but they were wise in some way. How they traveled a really long way based on prophecies of the Old Testament. There will be that piece. There will be the pieces of the songs and all of those things, God. But I pray that what would become tradition for us would be a greater level of understanding and depth in relationship based on what we know to be true about what these young people, about what this young lady experienced. Father, the truth is that I worship at the altar of comfort all the time. All the time I worship at the altar of comfort. I so want to be comforted. And I pray, Father, that I would stop missing opportunities, possible opportunities that you've presented me with, because I'm determined to be comfortable, because I need the familiar, because the unfamiliar bothers me, worries me, scares me, makes me uncomfortable. Father, I pray that we would search you out in a new way in the coming year, that we would seek out the unfamiliar, that we would leave the worship of the comfort behind, so that we could increase our availability to you, to be used by you for whatever purpose you would use.